Hello, my name is Danielle Hegarty, and welcome to this discussion on cross-dressing saints in medieval Europe. For this podcast, I will be briefly introducing the concept of cross-dressing and explore how this intersected with religiosity in the lives of three saints in particular. I will discuss the story of Saint Marina, Saint Euphrosyne, and Saint Theodora, who all used cross-dressing to express their extreme devotion to God. Following this, I will be taking some questions from listeners. Transvestism, according to Valerie Hotchkiss, can be defined as a clinical designation for the desire to dress like the opposite sex. Similarly, Bulow defined transvestism as the desire to dress in clothes and even assume the role of the opposite sex. In this podcast, I will be using transvestism, cross-dressing, and transgender synonymously, following the example of literature. Although it is difficult to be certain, scholars believe that the heritage of literary transgender saints either stems from pagan cult practices or from the story of Saint Thecla. To be quite brief, Saint Thecla offered to cut her hair and wear men's clothing in order to follow the Apostle Paul. Thecla's story makes it clear. A person's devotion to God could be proved and strengthened when they underwent gender transformations in order to fully devote themselves to their religion. Whatever the reason, transgender saints gained popularity in medieval literature, leaving modern scholars to grapple with the meaning of these texts and what their purpose truly was. In the medieval period, it was established that man was the measure of all things. Hotchkiss, in Clothes Make the Man, asserts that for early believers of Christianity, to be a Christian was to be male, or at least male-like. As noted by Sasha Grayson, from the 4th to the 15th centuries, laws were put in place that banned women from wearing men's clothes, which indicated that this was a regular, real-world concern for civic and ecclesiastic authorities, and not just a literary technique. The medieval transvestite's ambiguity led to the construction, challenge, and reconstruction of gender identity. Bulow's work confirms that cross-dressing allowed individuals to channel their feelings through dress while still being aware of their true maleness or femaleness. Female transvestites' existence, in particular, called for the re-examination of women's role in literature, female stereotypes, and society's perception of women in general. In this podcast, the focus will be on female crossdressers. By conforming to androcentric models through their assimilation of maleness, female crossdressers gave in to male hegemony and constructs of gender. Since female crossdressers are conforming to androcentrism, it is logical that they did receive approval when they decided to dress like men. This widespread acceptance led to an increase of female transvestites in medieval literature, making it a common literary device. Although cross-dressing was permitted in real life and in literature, it was only accepted to an extent, as described by Bulow. Bulow argues that in literary settings, cross-dressing women were not permitted to compete with men on stereotypical masculine grounds. In this way, transvestism influenced a person's status, giving them a kind of control over personal, religious, and social contexts. For a woman to transform herself into being male or male-like, she would be expected to abandon her feminine characteristics and appropriate male characteristics, as explained by Easton in Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? Transforming and Transcending Gender in the Lives of Female Saints. This transformation could be obtained through social, spiritual, and physical change. Likewise, Karras suggests that the conversion from sin to sanctity was thought to be the most profound transformation a medieval person could imagine, not only in behavior, but also in personality. It required an entire reorientation of identity. Roland Betancourt in Byzantine Intersectionality notes that the transformation from female to male usually affected the body's composition, especially in the religious contexts, since this typically required individuals to partake in ascetic practices, which altered their bodies into rougher, darker, and often a more faded beauty associated with the male body. Some of the physical transformations even resulted in deprivation and malnutrition, which Betancourt highlights as causing potentially withered breasts and the end of a woman's menstrual cycle, which makes the change even more concrete. A monk's gender, however, was not the result of his asceticism, but rather the cause of it, Betancourt reminds his readers. As we move into the relationship between gender and religiosity, it becomes more and more apparent that the two appear to be closely related. In order to become more masculine, women had to surrender their relationship with their bodies, which often led to a life of celibacy. In religious stories of cross-dressing, Easton asserts that cross-dressing stories did undermine the binary nature of gender, but that these women were only disguised temporarily, suggesting to readers that their original sex, so to speak, would persist and prevail. This is because although these saints live as men and die as men, they are eventually outed as biological women, normally without their consent, as Betancourt points out. Now that we've explored cross-dressing in the context of medieval Europe, we will see how this directly intersects with religion in literature centered around female saints. Before we dive into the three saints I mentioned earlier, I will first discuss a few important notes. First, most of the cross-dressing holy women had Greek origins, and there were approximately 40 saints who were documented as cross-dressing between the early days of Christianity to the 16th century, according to Easton. Grayson, in Disruptive Disguises, wrote how the attributes of holiness made subverting gender relatively easy for saints, since they traditionally wore unadorned, formless garments, which allowed them to hide distinguishing bodily features. Grayson adds on that theological teachings of chastity, seclusion, and privacy made gender transformations socially possible and even accessible. Additionally, it is important to remember that female saints dressed as males to gain status, whereas male saints lost status for dressing like a female. Additionally, holy women who cross-dress were condemned by the church, but nothing truly preventative was ever done. Some reasons that saints chose to cross-dress were that it allowed them to better serve God, maintain their virginity, escape marriage to a pagan, escape sexual abuse, or even just to fulfill a desire for worldly adventure in the eyes of both Hotchkiss and Grayson. Another reason altogether would be that these individuals were actually what modern people would understand as transgender or gender fluid, despite these labels not being used at the time. Betancourt asserts that some texts demonstrated that some individuals self-identified and perceived themselves as the gender that was not assigned to them at birth. Betancourt reiterates that perhaps not every medieval saint experienced this, and therefore it is accurate to say that the reasoning for cross-dressing varied. For the stories of Marina, Euphrosyne, and Theodora, I will be using Jacobus de Voragine's hagiography, in addition to Valerie Hotchkiss's hagiographic appendix. Hagiographies are a type of biography that detail the lives of saints. Explained by Grayson, hagiographies separate saintly gender subversion from daily affairs, with the realm of mystical and mythical allegorical teachings. As we learn about these saints, keep in mind that these stories were constructed to tell a story of formulaic detail that doesn't accurately reflect the lives of actual medieval people. They do, though, offer insight into medieval ideas on sanctity. Let's move now into a brief introduction of Jacobus de Voorjean and his hagiographic work entitled The Golden Legend. Jacobus was born in 1230, entering the Dominican order in 1244 as a teacher and administrator. In 1260, he wrote The Golden Legend. Following this, he became the Archbishop of Genoa in 1292 and was considered a peacemaker and a father to the poor. Jacobus died in 1298, but his hagiographic writing lived on, becoming the second most read book in the Middle Ages, second only to the Bible. The first saint I'll be talking about is Saint Marina. Marina was an only child to a man named Eugenius. After losing her mother and having her father join a monastery, she was left to stay with relatives. Eugenius began to miss his daughter and expressed this to the abbot. The abbot, assuming Marina to be a boy, invited her to come to live at the monastery with her father. Marina decides to dress in boy's clothing and be called Marinus to avoid detection by others in the monastery. After living in the monastery for many years as Marinus, her father passes when she is 27 years old. On his deathbed, Eugenius tells Marina to keep her femaleness a secret from everyone. A time later, Marinus was instructed to gather wood, which required her to stay overnight at an inn. The innkeeper's daughter becomes pregnant and accuses Marinus of impregnating her. When confronted by the abbot, Marinus claimed, "Father, I have sinned," despite the accusation being entirely false. She was then exiled from the monastery with her assumed child. She suffered outside the gates for 5 years until she was invited back into the monastery shortly before her death. When the monks discovered her sex following her death, the abbot expressed extreme regret and buried Marina respectfully. The innkeeper's daughter became possessed and only recovered when she confessed her sins at Marina's grave. So Marina's story teaches its readers that to suffer is to evoke the figure of Christ, as she confesses to a sin she did not even commit. In fact, she suffered silently for 5 years, mothering a child which wasn't even hers. Hotchkiss, speaking on Marina's story, suggests that Marina conformed to the idea of the female sinner, despite the narrative claim of total integration among males. This is because she remains a woman in the narrator's and reader's mind. Moving on now to our second saint is Euphrosyne. And Euphrosyne used her gender inversion in order to maintain celibacy. Euphrosyne's father, Paphnutius of Alexandria, wished for his daughter to marry a wealthy nobleman against her desire to remain celibate. Euphrosyne decided to leave her home in order to join a convent under the disguise of a man. Euphrosyne was, from then on, called Smaragdus. At the convent, her beauty became a distraction for the monks. Because of this, Smaragdus was ordered to remain in her cell. Her father, Paphnutius, came to the convent and was sent to see Smaragdus. For 30 years, Smaragdus comforted Paphnutius about the loss of his daughter. On her deathbed, Smaragdus told her father the truth. He buried her and lived the rest of his life in her cell. After Euphrosyne's death, abbots prayed at her grave in hopes that they too would manfully go to heaven. Euphrosyne's story points to the extreme measures that women had to go to in order to appear manly. In fact, Euphrosyne was so transformed that her own father was unable to identify her. Her unrecognizable transformation was explained in the text by a mixture of extreme fasting, late vigils, and excessive crying, in addition to a change of clothes and haircut. Both Marina and Euphrosyne prove how women were sometimes not only equal to men, but even surpassed their level of virtue and strength of character. I also want to point out how significant it is that the text views the words manfully in the context of going to heaven. This is really important since it points towards a full transformation that Euphrosyne was believed to have gone through. The last saint of interest today is Saint Theodora. She lived in Alexandria under the rule of Emperor Zeno. To begin, the devil became envious of Theodora because of her holiness and stirred up in her a lust for another man, despite the fact that she was already married. This man that the devil sent to Theodora showered her with gifts and was so persistent that she eventually fell ill. The devil then sent a witch to convince Theodora to give in to the man's pursuit. Theodora resisted until the witch told her that God is able to watch her during the day, but is unable to watch her at night. After hearing this, Theodora relented and had sex with the man when night fell. In the morning after, Theodora felt extreme regret, crying that she had lost her soul and destroyed her virtue. When her husband came home, he found her to be inconsolable. She decided to visit a monastery where an abbess told her the truth, that God could see her even at night. Then she decided to cut her hair and don men's clothing and returned to the monastery, where she would live for many years as Theodore. Years later, Theodore was hauling oil in the city when she saw her husband. Her husband, who thinks that his wife has left him for another man, does not recognize her. Her husband had been told by an angel to go to a certain street, and there he would meet his wife. He felt deceived after not seeing his wife. During her time at the monastery, Theodora performed many miracles, which really angered the devil, who reacted by threatening her and swearing at her. One day, Theodora stayed somewhere overnight and was asked by a woman to sleep with her, which Theodora declined. The woman ended up sleeping with somebody else and became pregnant, accusing Theodora of being the father. As a result, Theodora was expelled from the monastery with the child, staying outside the gates of the monastery for 7 years. The devil then transfigured into her husband's form and begged Theodora to live with him again. Theodora declined, wishing to repent for her sins instead. She was eventually invited back into the monastery because of her patience. In her room at the monastery, the monks overheard her speaking to the child lovingly, as she would her own son. She later died, the boy crying over her. And that very night, the abbot had a vision of a wedding where a woman walked enveloped in ineffable glory. The abbot heard that this woman was Brother Theodore and was told the truth about Theodora. Upon waking, the abbot found his vision to be completely true. He met Theodora's father, who cried over her body and buried her solemnly. Her husband lived in her cell until his death, and her foster son was later elected as the new abbot. With a string of similarities to both Marina's and Euphrosyne's stories, it becomes clear just how formulaic cross-dressing tales are. With Theodora living outside the monastery for 7 years and Marina's 5 years, it becomes clear that holy transvestites are only considered worthy of sainthood after they've completed a successful and prolonged gender conversion. Often, the mark of time was the only thing that made the holy figures forgive these women for their supposed sins. It is important to discuss cross-dressing saints because they are understudied and underappreciated in comparison to some other very mainstream and popular saints. These three saints can offer insight into how cross-dressing could intersect and strengthen one's faith. As previously mentioned, though, this gender transformation submitted to an androcentric world, one in which women were praised for releasing their femaleness for masculinity. Hotchkiss asserts that through an understanding of medieval cross-dressing and an inspection of transvestite saints, it becomes clear that gender boundaries were blurred long before the modern era. Now, we have audience callers who have submitted some questions about medieval cross-dressing that I will be answering.
Hello, my name is Sarah Spore. I'm calling from Port Coquitlam, British Columbia. I'm a huge fan of your podcast. My question today is, was it more common for medieval cross-dressers to be male or female? And if you do know, why that might be the case. Thanks, Danielle. You rock. Go, girl. Bye now.
Hello, thank you for your question. It was more common for females to cross-dress than it was for males. Valerie Hotchkiss attributed this to femininity restricting women's freedom and lowering their social status. Because dressing as a man increased a person's status, they were encouraged to do so, whereas men were discouraged. Bulow thought female cross-dressers were tolerated because striving to be more manlike was thought to make them better people. Men were also believed to be using cross-dressing in order to have easier sexual access to women, which was very discouraged.
Hello, Danielle. I'm Wendy Steele. I'm calling because I had never heard of hagiography before. I'm wondering if hagiographies are typically fiction or nonfiction, or maybe they could be a mixture of both. Thank you for taking my call. And more importantly, thank you for blessing the world with your podcast, dear. Bye now.
Really great question. Thank you for calling. Hagiographies are partly fiction. Although some of the details are in fact true, there are many aspects of the stories that are fictionalized. The details that are intentionally false are present in these stories in order to teach women lessons about sanctity, womanhood, masculinity, and even devotion.
Hey! This is so cool that you might be hearing this. My name is Gretchen T. Slay, and my question is, when women cross-dress, did they lose all of their feminine traits, or did some stick around even though they were dressing like a man? See ya!
Man, what a good question. In literature, women retain a few feminine traits where they are still distinguishable from their male counterparts. Hotchkiss notes that some of the traits they retain include sexual vulnerability, sinfulness, maternal instincts, and concerns for their family. And with the knowledge that we now have, we can see in both Marina and Theodora how they prove that despite their gender transformation, they both keep their maternal instincts in raising children who are not their own. And Euphrosyne exemplifies concerns for the family and how she continues to support her father.
Hi. I'm a new listener, Danielle, but I wanted to ask you, if a male cross-dresser was also a prostitute, were they condemned for their prostitution or for their cross-dressing? Or both? Yeah, that's all, I guess.
Hello, yeah, that is a tricky question. Karis, in Prostitution and the Question of Sexual Identity, writes that male transvestite prostitutes are commonly not labeled as sodomites, but rather as gender inversions. It is questionable, though, which offense was considered worse according to medieval law and religion, but hopefully that kind of points you in the right direction.
Hey, Danielle, it's Felicity calling again. You responded to me last week, so I was hoping we could make it 2 weeks in a row. Can you please tell me what caused the hostility against cross-dressers in medieval Europe? Was it political, social, or religious teachings that first condemned it? Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Awesome. Thank you for your call. To narrow the purpose down to one source is fairly difficult. Boulot, however, feels that one of the causes or sources was this biblical quote: "The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are an abomination unto the Lord thy God."
Morning, Danielle. Do you know how medieval artistic representations depicted crossdressers? Thank you. You're the best.
Thank you for your message. Medieval art depicting cross-dressing women often showed their persisting femininity by having the transvestite saint doing an activity that is stereotypically female gendered, according to Easton. In this way, some art did distinguish between male monks and the cross-dressing woman. Some other art, however, didn't make any differences between the men and the transvestite saint, which might have created a little bit of suspicion among viewers about the true identity of other religious figures if this saint was so easily disguised.
Hello, hey, this is Alina. I'm calling all the way from, I don't really know where I am, but anyways, I was wondering, would you be able to tell me if unisex clothing was present in the medieval period, or was, like, all clothing gendered at the time? I really hope this is you, by the way. It'll be a little bit awkward if it wasn't. Thanks. Bye.
What a good question. Unisex clothing was present in the medieval period. Although a lot of the clothing worn by medieval people could be argued as very gendered, unisex clothing was really common for children in particular. The reason for this, as stated by Grayson, was that children were thought of as pre-sexual beings, and this made unisex clothing for children a true staple of childhood.
Hi, Danielle, this is Rob. I have a question for you. What were some traits women were believed to have according to medieval religious texts that they were criticized for having? Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. That was a genius question. Thank you. I will be using Roland Betancourt's work to answer this. So note that the religious text he's citing is Byzantine sources. The Byzantine Empire is also thought of as the Eastern Roman Empire for a little bit of context. Regarding your question, though, Betancourt lists being sexually excessive, smelling musky, ensnaring, web weaving, soft white flesh, high shrill voices, and uncontrollable emotions as just a few of the traits that women were thought to embody in the medieval period, and likewise were expected to minimize. And it is the absence of these traits that marked masculinity in the perspective of Byzantine writers. And with that, that is our final call and the end of the podcast. With this new knowledge, I hope that you can make meaningful conversations about cross-dressing in medieval Europe and understand how this relates to present-day representations of cross-dressing. Thank you for listening to this podcast and to the listeners for submitting such thoughtful and engaging questions. I leave you today with Roland Betancourt's reminder that manly women and womanly men today and throughout history are very much real, just as much as cisgendered people. Thank you.